Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show. Remember them? This one goes back to 1971, Sylvia's mother. I haven't heard this song in 35 years, maybe. My gosh. Good to hear it again. Hey, the world, I don't need to tell you this, is going absolutely gaga over this Pokemon Go. And I won't pretend to understand it, except that it's made the company that designed it billions of dollars, and it's all my 9-year-old twin boys talk about. And it's caused a few people who had their heads buried in their smartphone and their iPods to fall off cliffs or fall down manholes or whatever. You saw that coming, didn't you? Well, now a Pokemon Go player has ventured out into Area 51, of all places, in search of Pokemon characters. And you can read more about it in the news section at coasttocoastam.com. And it's all left me wondering, are there any Pokemon characters out there called Camo Dudes? All right, when we come back, Colony Collapse Disorder. Where have all the bees gone? This has been a mystery for the last 10 years. And my guest, George Scott, a beekeeper for the last 25 years and an expert in chemical pesticides, may just have nailed down the answer. And he's got a solution. We'll also delve into the amazing, fascinating secret life of bees. This is Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Please stay a while. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you, broadcasting live from Coasts Toronto, Canada, affiliate talk radio AM 640. The next 2 hours, where have all the bees gone? George Scott is a beekeeper and expert in chemical insecticides. He's been a Niagara, Canada resident all his life and has run a series of successful environmental-focused businesses, including chemical and soil remediation, irrigation systems, wind and solar generation, and most recently, beekeeping. With a degree from the University of Western Ontario in economics and a background in chemical product development, sales, and global distribution, George's experience in business development, global trade, and contact negotiation, customs brokerage, and worldwide sales strategy. A registered beekeeper for more than 25 years, George is a passionate advocate for beekeeping as a crucial component for Ontario's agricultural success, now and in the future. He's a member of the Niagara Beekeepers Association. In 2001, he founded the Niagara Beeway, dedicated to the protection and preservation of Niagara's honeybee populations. George believes that the survival and health of the beekeeping industry is pivotal and is totally aligned to the mandate and concerns of the OFA at many levels. He's an avid outdoorsman and maintains a 50-acre farm producing biodiversity-based crops, honeybees, woodlot nursery crops, and continued research. George Scott, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Great. Thanks for that lovely introduction, Richard.
All right. Colony collapse disorder. Now, I need you to straighten this out for me because, you know, prior to, let's say, the last 10 years, you know, there are sort of die-offs within the honeybee population, hives. We have things like the spring dwindle and May disease and an autumn collapse and a fall dwindle. But this is something different now that we're talking about over the last 10 years, is it not?
Absolutely. Since the introduction of this new pesticide, and this is an insecticide, so we're going to focus down on that a little bit. Since the introduction of that, it has become overwhelmingly the number one product used in agriculture and now in urban insect control. And the problem with it is that it's stepping us into a brand new era of understanding about chemicals. I think in the last, give our farmers a great pat on the back for really understanding and coming to grips with a term that we're all familiar with, I think, and that's parts per million. You know, a big man like yourself, you get cut, you get infected, doesn't look good for you, you take a little bit of a thing called antibiotic, it's parts per million in your body, and the problem goes away. Farmers add a little bit of a nutrient to their soil and their water when they're putting their fertilizer in, and parts per million, and their plants recover beautifully. The problem that with this new insecticide is this is not a parts per million thing. This is a fully active chemical in parts per billion. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, it doesn't sound like a math question, but what's really happening here is these are things that we have never seen in our entire evolution as DNA-based creatures. That's why they're so effective at killing the insect, is because the insects have never seen them before. So they're focused right in on the nervous system of these creatures, and the creatures can't detect it, and that's why it's really preferred by farmers. But say something like in parts per billion, where you used to put half of your tank, fill it up with DDT, the other half with water, so you've got a big 6,000-gallon tank, and you're going down the field, you're a farmer, you're going to spray. Now you only need 1 liter.
My word, this is really...
And it's much more effective.
And when you, what are we talking about here? Is this what we refer to as the neonicotinoid?
Yes, it's a chlorinated nicotine product. So it's like a super effective salt, really. That's how it travels through our system, like sodium chloride or potassium chloride or magnesium chloride. This is a nicotine chlorinated material. So it's going to be removed by things like your kidneys, which take salt out. Then where it's so effective in plants is that it's never removed from the plants. It's systemic. When a plant absorbs this through the seed coating or a foliar spray or a soil quench, the plant absorbs it all and it can't get rid of it because it doesn't have a thing that we animals have, and those are called kidneys. Our kidneys will remove that. In the application of these neonicotinoids for flea and tick control, the reason that you have to put this on every month is because the dog has a system, it has kidneys, it can remove them. So it slowly weakens it, and the product is urinated out of most dogs.
So we're literally swimming in neonicotinoids. It's in flea power. We're spraying it for aphids on our roses, on our lawns. It's in the fruits and vegetables. It's everywhere.
Well, we're finding the study of the life cycle of where is it really going and how are we really being affected and where is it showing up is really what's really opening up our eyes now. And when we see things like such large quantities of this material being released in agriculture, and we study agriculture, blame the farmers. And in fact, for Niagara, maybe not the same everywhere, but and I can't really step out of Niagara to make this statement. However, in your own areas, wherever you are, if you do have a look, you may find the same concluding numbers in the fact that the farmers use this product pretty much as a seed coating once a year in the spring. Urban users, however, use it on their dog every month in quantities far exceeding farm usage. In Niagara, our two major companies who provide farmers with soybean seed or corn seed for their planting, they put the coatings on for the farmers, and the farmers put those plants in the springtime. And those farmers very, very infrequently would use an insecticide again because the plants have that insect protection. However, non-farmers or urban people are putting it on their dogs every month. There are 560 new products that have come out for consumers now. And that's where the majority of the product is, because if you add up all of the seed coating materials used by Pioneer and Clark Agrichem, two outstanding agricultural companies full of great guys. We've worked with them for years and they couldn't be more helpful. But they only use about 30,000 pounds each, or about a truckload each. And when you look at what was on the ground in January when we did the survey, and these are for pest control companies. These are people spraying in your dentist's office. You never see a centipede running across the dentist floor. Why? Because if there was, he would call the pest control guy, and the guy would come in at night and spray. And these new neonicotinoids have replaced many of the old sprays because they're so easy to handle, and of course, they're registered as being very safe. So that's an issue where all of a sudden when we start counting up the number of truckloads used by urban people, in January it was 6 truckloads ready to be released. That's in inventory, in the veterinarian's office, in the pest control places, in the ornamental areas of the nurseries, things that are non-food production, things
right.
where it wasn't designed for.
So, George, this is no longer a theory. You have, I mean, this is now, you've solved this mystery, or your, other researchers and yourself, you've solved this mystery. It's not about GMOs. It's not about some strange fungus or a mite. This is neonicotinoids are causing this colony collapse disorder. Can we say that with certainty?
Undoubtedly, however, when you're bumping into a $6.6 billion sale per year, what you really want to do as a chemical manufacturer is you want to split the audience in half, saying, well, it might be and it might not be. It may be a parasite, or it may be another disease, or it may be cyclical. In this particular case, that's just not so. Neonicotinoids are the number one problem faced by bees right now. And what we're finding after 10 or 12 years of use in Niagara is these effects are now cumulative. This chemical is not behaving as the manufacturer stated. The manufacturers state that it will degrade in the environment in a certain time. Under a year, 220 days, I believe, is the expected degrade date. Well, in Niagara, that just doesn't work for us. That's why this chemical is very inappropriate for us, because the only thing that breaks down neonicotinoids, it doesn't break down in your composter, it doesn't break down with microbes, it doesn't break down with other chemicals. It only breaks down in the face and in the presence of solar radiation. But here in Niagara, we've got a very weird thing that happens to us for about 4 or 5 months a year. It's called snow. And we get about 2 feet
I've
of
heard
it.
of that.
That means that the sun is not ever hitting the ground. For 5 months of the year, plus we have very, very limited sunlight hours because our winter days are very short. So this chemical is not degrading in 200 days. It's more like 1,200 days.
Oh,
And
my.
if you're a typical applier of this chemical, if you apply it one time, you see a bug, and you apply it another time, you still have a tremendous amount of residual in your soil or in your home or wherever you're using it on your plants that you cannot detect. And you're giving it another application, and it's not going away. That cumulative effect is now what we are starting to monitor. We're offering a program here where we're looking at it because so much study has been done on the food. And almost 70% of the food that you eat now contains neonicotinoids. Everything made by corn, everything made by soybean, most of the oils, so many other products, almost all of your animal feed, they're all fed by corn and soybean, and every mouthful that they eat contains a small amount of this. And there isn't a lot of study information to see if it's bioaccumulating in us and how is it passed through, because we do have kidneys and we can get rid of it. But we are being exposed at an enormous level. And here in Niagara, we do not have diagnostic tools. None of our doctors have the ability to look for this chemical.
George Scott is the founder of the Niagara Beeway. He's a beekeeper for the last 25 years. Now, how bad is it when we're talking about this colony collapse disorder? First of all, I gave kind of a very vague overview of what it is, but give me some details about what has happened to beehive colonies over the last 10 or 12 years.
Well, what's happening is all of a sudden you'll open up a box of bees where there would be normally a colony of 60,000 bees in there, males and females, predominantly females, which are the workers, the nursing bees, the ventilators, the ones that make honey, the ones that make comb. They're all specific duties in those bees. And you'll have one queen. And what's happening now specifically is that when you expose honeybees to this chemical at very, very, very low doses, it affects their nervous system. But if you look at a bee and you have a very close look at it, the brain of the bee is mostly connected to its eyes. So when the bee leaves the hive, it has the ability to avoid birds, it has the ability to find plants, it has the ability to find landmarks, it has the ability to navigate, it has the ability to go back and forth from the hive, to communicate with others, to see other predatory insects. However, this chemical goes to the places where the nervous system is most active. So if you're mostly nervous system and eyes, the problem that you start to see before colony collapse disorder is that the bees in flying to their entrance are bouncing all over the place. And all of a sudden, there are no more bees in the box. And we can't even find bees to test them to tell you if it is iodine poisoning or neonicotinoid poisoning. And the reason that we believe this is happening is when those bees get the information from their scouts, that little wiggle dance of a cherry tree 2.5 kilometers away, turn right at the big oak tree,
That's amazing, and I want to circle back to that at some point, talking about this language. Yes.
For scouts to tell foragers, so one scout can tell 200 foragers where to go, but that's done inside the hive where it's dark. That's a tactile dance where they wiggle, and the bees will touch it. They've got the information, so they have the information from the scout. They know where the cherry tree is. Off they go. They go down to the bottom of the entrance of the hive. Out they go. They know where to fly. But the problem is they've been contaminated with neonicotinoids, and it's going into their nervous system, and it where they are most active is where that chemical wants to be most active or most present, and that's in their vision area. The bees can get to the tree, but they can't get back to the hive. The bees can leave because they've got that tactile information about where they're supposed to go. But they have not been able to register the landmarks and able to find the hive again. And even if they do, it's hard to find the entrance because it's like flying into an airport where you can't look out the windows and see where you're landing. So slowly but surely, as this chemical becomes more and more and more as the bees age, and most of these foragers who are summer bees, they only live 35 days. So during that 35-day period, they are getting this exposure to this chemical. And slowly but surely, they're losing their ability to see. So as they leave, they're gone. And they can't find their way back, and we can't find them to test them. So now you are a beekeeper. You open a box that used to have 60,000 bees in there, and you get a small cluster of bees in the top of the hive. And those are the ones that just hatched the last 2 days, because all of the adult bees were running out of food, and they were reassigned to being foragers, and off they went, and they never returned.
And there's not enough adults to take care of the baby bees.
And the babies hatch, and there's no one there, and all of a sudden you find something like, oh, all of a sudden the queen is in distress because she's a bee, she's exposed to this chemical. And that's where we're really spending an awful lot of time now on how to mitigate our losses. We're not here to blame anybody. We live in a real world, okay? We're not here to say ban the chemical. We're not those type of people. We're saying this is what the chemical does. The chemical companies may have missed it. It took us 10 or 12 years to figure this out, but now we're quite plainly looking right at the facts. If you expose bees to neonicotinoids, they will perish. If the queen is in distress, she's the key to the whole program. They may not be able to make another queen because there are no eggs coming out of a faltering queen, so the whole colony perishes. So now what we are doing is we are frequently replacing our queens, and it happens right now. Between now and about the midway through August is when they're really pulling all of the food into the hive, and that's when we start to see queen distress. We lost a couple of queens last week in very, very healthy hives, very strong, very vibrant new queens. They just perished. So what we do is we install new queens in order to preserve that hive. So that's not a brand new business, but the volume of that business for beekeepers has gone right through the roof.
All right, we're going to run into a timeout here in a moment, and we'll take a break, come back, George. But just very quickly, give me a sense of when this colony collapse disorder was at its height. What was the level of die-off in your hives, in your colonies?
We lost 100% in some bee yards. We 100%. Lost every bee. There was tons of food in the hives. There was every bee was gone, or small clumps of young bees were found dead in the box.
All right, listen, we'll pick this up on the other side. George, pardon my interruption. Here's Ray Charles, Shake a Tail Feather, taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. Vampire Weekend and Unbelievers. Still waiting for Governor Mike Pence of Indiana to phone in. We've left a hotline number for him to explain why his lovely daughter's reflection didn't show up in the mirror in that photograph he tweeted. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's in the news section. Lex Lonehood, our webmaster, has posted it there up at the website coasttocoastam.com. I was talking about Pokemon Go a little while ago. Of course, the world has just gone crazy over Pokemon Go. And did you hear Russian President Vladimir Putin has banned Pokemon Go in his country? And this is a story coming from the folks at yournewswire.com. It says, Vladimir Putin set to ban Pokemon Go from Russia after an internal Kremlin investigation revealed the viral augmented reality smartphone game has direct links to the CIA and wider intelligence community and is being used to secretly gather data on a colossal scale. Young people are being tricked into giving up their privacy to these intelligence agencies, according to Kremlin sources, and while playing the game, they act as unwitting intelligence gatherers for the CIA. The game has an extensive list of intrusive tracking permissions, and it's these fine print clauses that raised eyebrows in the Kremlin and sparked the ongoing investigation. The game's creator, Niantic, is closely linked to the CIA. Niantic CEO John Hanke, created Keyhole in 2001, which was later bought by Google. Most of the money used to create Keyhole came from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and the CIA. Again, this is all according to Kremlin sources and yournewswire.com. Pokemon Go is the pinnacle of Hank's intelligence gathering career thus far. He is a New World Order intelligence operator whose career has been creating ingenious ways to spy on unsuspecting citizens and siphon the information back to the intelligence agencies. Okay, so that's Newswire, yournewswire.com, and Kremlin sources. I'm not sure if any of this is true, but this is the excuse I'll be giving my twin boys as to why they can't have Pokemon Go. Is that mean? Oh, I don't know. All right, when we come back, my conversation with George Scott Beekeeper, the founder of the Niagara Beeway, and let me just lay some amazing honeybee facts on you. Honey is the only food that includes all the substances necessary to sustain life, including enzymes, vitamins, minerals, and water, and it's the only food that contains pinosembrin, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, an antioxidant associated with improved brain functioning. Get me to the honey jar. Back with more of my conversation with George Scott when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. George Scott stays with us, the founder of the Niagara Beeway. The website is www.niagarabeeway.com, and we're talking about colony collapse disorder, and George has identified the culprit. It's a group of chemical pesticides called neonicotinoids. How were you and others able to piece this together, George?
Well, when we started looking at it, if you go onto the website and you go to the We Want to Know section, you'll see a little 3-minute video that was put together by some high school kids because they couldn't find out any information about this. You know, kids don't ask their dad how to put the tie on at Thanksgiving. They Google it. They're just, that's the way they get their information. However, when they want to find out how much neonicotinoids, which is used on all corn, how much is in their cornflakes, mysteriously, they cannot find any data on that at all. Is it because it's not tested or not available? And if it's so good for us, that's a problem. So they made this little video up, and that's really what got me on the road here, talking about the awareness. That's what got us as chemical guys into this whole thing, to really look at the real life cycle of the neonicotinoids and how it really came to market. And 10 years later, what are we living with today? Yes, it's in 70% of our food, but we can't find water here in Niagara anymore that doesn't have it in it. Only 2 to 20% of this product is sucked up into the plant. So that's exactly what the farmer wants. The plant's protected from insect predation by as little as 2% of that seed coating. But the other 98%, being water soluble, is in the soil. And it is not behaving the way the manufacturer said here in Niagara. And all of a sudden now, every time it rains, water becomes the vehicle of transport into our waterways. And that's what we're looking at right now, because why bother looking at the 2% that's in our food when the 98% is in our water? The first time it was used here locally by the Mennonites, who are my neighbors, and they're very conscientious farmers. They used it one time. Immediately following the usage of that, we lost 100% of our bee yard. That's never happened to me before in 29 years of being a beekeeper. To say that it's a parasite or a virus or all that, that really opened our eyes, saying that, well, possibly it could have been a virus. We accepted that and we looked at that. And there were many viruses. If you take a bee apart, you'll find just about every bee virus, they carry all of them. But they have an immune system, like you're not going to die of smallpox. Your ancestors already went through that. You are the survivor today if you're exposed to smallpox. And you can fight it off because you are resistant to it. What we're finding today is the 98% of the neonicotinoids that are coming to us in the water are affecting our immunodeficiency responses. So all of a sudden we are, well, I guess the way you would put it is we are like AIDS patients now. We're dying of pneumonia. That is an immune response to something, because our immune system has been pulled down by, not a virus, but in this particular case, a chemical. And when this chemical hits our immune system, it has a whole bunch of things that we're just now starting to study, because there are two things in the world that are very, very complex in the human body. One is, how does the brain work? That's a real mystery for us. Yes, we know a lot about that, but there's still a lot that we don't know. And the other system is the immune system. Neonicotinoids have an impact on the behavior and the immune system of most creatures, and most creatures that have a nervous system. So that would include us as well as bees. So we are now taking those lessons that we have learned from the bees, and we are looking at, how does it affect our poultry industry? How does it affect our hog industry? How does it affect our plants now that they've been exposed to it for 10 years? All of a sudden now you'll find that OMAFRA is looking at some of the funguses and viruses that attack our orchards. And they're saying, geez, you know, is there a relationship between the immune response of these trees and now the aggressive loss of farmland because these orchards are being attacked by things that they normally could defend themselves? Right. I believe that this is the new science. This is where we are going. This is what's going to take us 10 to 20 years to really understand. Even if they discontinued neonicotinoids today, they've already released $6 billion a year for 10 years.
Right.
That's $60 billion worth of a chemical that is now in our system.
It's going to take decades and decades
to really understand where we're going with this.
Okay, so you've come up with a novel approach to save your bees. Let's take a few moments and talk about that.
Well, for our bees, what we do is, there's no doubt that this insecticide kills them, so what are we going to do as beekeepers? So as beekeepers, we know where it is, and we believe that the water is the main vector. However, when the plants that are treated with neonicotinoids go to flower, at that particular time, we intercept the bees from going to those plants by feeding them. We provide them a type of bee food that's so attractive to them that they don't have to go to that. For the 5 to 10 days that the plants are flowering, we provide them clean water and we provide them with a feed source that intercepts them. That has been remarkably successful in reducing our losses. The second step is that we're refrigerating our bees. As we used to leave them in the field, you know, you'd see them snow-covered fields and you'd see the beehives out there as you drive through the country. That practice now is disappearing because there are many changes in January where you have a warm day. And as the temperature gets up above 10 degrees, all of a sudden the bees wake up and they get a little bit more hungry. So they have uneven levels of eating, uneven levels of moving around. When you refrigerate them, you even that out. So as we store our bees over the wintertime in a climate-controlled area, it's a little bit more expensive. We have to spend more money, but it avoids the whole neonicotinoid thing by planning for that. We work with our farmers here. We know where they're putting it and when, and we know those plants and when they're going to flower. So we make some decisions about how do we help our bees to avoid that. Two easy steps, feed them and refrigerate them, have changed our mortality from as high as 100% to this past year where we did the primary experiments on many of our bee yards. In some of our yards, our losses were less than 5%. And that's a better program than any of our grandfathers ever did. So by implementing these two steps, by acknowledging the fact that this chemical is an insecticide and taking steps to avoid it, we still have varroa mite, we still have parasites, we still have viruses, but by taking these steps to avoid the neonicotinoid contamination in our bees, we have reduced our mortality to the point now where we are very profitable, taking this technology to other beekeepers. We're showing them how to do this, and this is going to be the way of the future.
George, a couple of things come to mind. If your bees then are being are avoiding these, let's say, fruit blooms, let's say apple trees, apple blossoms, then you're feeding them something else, doesn't that affect the taste of the honey? Because they're no longer using, let's say, apple blossom. We no longer have apple blossom honey. We have honey that's a result of whatever you're feeding them.
Well, there aren't very many apple people now who are ordering pollination services that are using neonicotinoids. Most of the orchard people have really made that decision already not to expose bees to this. So in my neighborhood here, where we're predominantly rural, predominantly farmers, we talk to each other. You know, we don't hate the grain farmers. We are the grain farmers. You know, we don't hate the beekeepers. We are the beekeepers. So we work together to say, you know, do we have an insect problem? Do we need to put insecticide out there? Is it just a prophylactic because someone said we should put it on there? Or are these the only seeds we can buy? That was the case for almost 10 years. Now there are some choices, and farmers are making those choices. It's now law that the farmers are now reducing their use of neonicotinoids, and the target is 80% reduction.
However, well, that's good news. That's good news.
It isn't the responsibility of the farmers. It is now the responsibility of the urban dwellers. We are 6 truckloads versus 2 truckloads. The farmers use 2 and get 100% of the blame. The urban people on your roses, on your dog's sleepy area, on the dog itself, on your ornamental flowers and ornamental products that are going into your butterfly gardens, those are the main areas of concern. We, as urban people, blame the farmers, but in fact, we are 3 times in truckload quantities. We are 3 times more users of these chemicals than the farmers are.
Give us a sense of how effective honeybees are at pollinization.
How effective bees are at colonization?
No, pollinizing or pollinization.
Oh, well, they're an amazing creature. I love them. Are you kidding? When they have young, the difference between the Niagara bee and the bee that is in the blueberry areas in Nova Scotia or New Brunswick is that we have a bit of a microclimate here. We grow grapes here. We have orchards here. They don't have them in Barrie. They don't have them in Ottawa. Those are unsuitable places, really, to have a large pollinator industry. Niagara has a great tradition and a great reputation on a national scale. All the biggest beekeepers are right here in Niagara. Niagara is one of the most God-gifted, beautiful places on the planet. We have the right kind of winter. We have the right kind of rural setting here to grow honeybees. Adding neonicotinoids into the home of the honeybee in Niagara really needs to be reconsidered. This is a real problem. We don't have that kind of insect damage on our soybean and corn to justify spending the odd $29 an acre. You know, you talk to most farmers, if he has to buy neonicotinoids and put them on his farm, it's $29 an acre. But if you ask him, how much insect damage did you have? you may find a number like $5 or $6. So farmers are now seeing that after 10 years and saying, you know what, maybe I'll skip a year and see how the insects do. And that has been cutting the neonicotinoids from farm usage, right, every other year is a 50% reduction right off the bat.
But if bees aren't doing the pollinating and it's left up to, let's say, the wind, for example, I mean, give me a contrast that for me. How effective bees are at pollinating compared to, let's say, the wind or some other insect?
Well, here at the Niagara Beeway, although we do love bees, you'll see that we're into all of the other pollinators too. And what we're seeing is that insect pollination is much more effective for many plants that require an insect. But we are really monitoring the bees because we make money from bees. We're not really monitoring the dragonflies because, you know, if all the dragonflies disappeared, someone would notice a year from now. When the bees start disappearing, that's an insurance claim. Everybody knows about it.
Right.
So what's happening is it's not just the apple trees and the cherries and our food production area, but all of the native species that have flowers and want to make seeds and want to reproduce, if they're not being visited by a pollinator, an insect, because the insects are wiped out, whether they are bees or not, that means that they don't make seeds. That means their rate of survival or those things that eat the seeds also decline. And that's what we're seeing. Birds are declining. Native species are declining. They're having a rough time. And it's not just pollution. Really, it is that interaction, that complex web of life that is the pollinators and the native species. That's a problem when you knock off anything that's in that food chain. You knock out one section of it, all of a sudden you find out that it's interconnected and so dependent on some other things. We're very concerned about all of the plants here in Niagara that require pollinators because, you know, we monitor the monarch butterfly, for an example. We normally have 800. We are registered MNR monarch breeders here. Normally we would have 800 at this time in a week would run through our facility here. We have three so far this year.
Oh,
it isn't like they're in a little bit of trouble. I would say for the monarch butterfly, even though they're tracking their populations, etc., it's a disaster for them. And same
what
with
about
any pollinators.
What about the other end of the migration? Are they being are they down in numbers in Costa Rica?
There's some conflicting reports about the size, and there are two different migrations, the east migration and the west migration, but they're multi-generational. To get to Ontario, the monarchs that are egged out and born here, they are going to make the entire trip all the way back down to Mexico and to the south in the tropics, where they will overwinter. The other monarchs, it takes them 2 to 3 generations in this year just to get here. So those are your 35-day monarchs. They only live for 35 days.
Mm.
And when you intercept generation number 2 down as they come over the cotton belt, you know, that whole Georgia, Arkansas, that whole area where cotton is the number one product down in that area, cotton is a product that needs insecticides. Every insect wants to get into that cotton ball and eat it. So they have a big problem, and insect resistance in the cotton is very high. Neonicotinoids is a godsend for the solution for insects for the cotton farmer. But that's right on the migration, and it's an immense area, and that's like generation 2 for the monarch. And that's where the monarchs are really being pounded down. So there is very few individuals in generation number 3 that are getting up to Ontario to make the overwintering ones. So that's,
all right, George, I
got to
jump in here. We're going to take a time out. As go the monarchs, go the bees, so go we. George Scott stays with us, and we will open up the phone lines at the bottom of the next hour, but we'll also delve into the remarkable secret lives of bees. We'll talk about foragers, scouts, workers, ventilators, bee comb makers, and more. George Scott, founder of the Niagara Beeway, right here on Coast to Coast AM.